I'm here today with Chris Jarvis, who is an expert on corporate volunteer programs and the co-founder of Realized Worth. He's joining us from the States, and I'm in Buenos Aires. We have a bit of a delay on the line today, but nonetheless, I'm really excited to have Chris with us to share his 20 years of experience working with nonprofits and with corporations on their corporate volunteering programs. So, Chris, thank you.
Glad to be here.
Thanks. Could you give us a little bit about your background and how your background being the executive director of two nonprofits led you to found Realized Worth, whose sole focus is on employee volunteer programs?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's an interesting journey. I think most people today who are involved with corporate social responsibility or sustainability within a company kind of get there by an indirect route, since it's a fairly new concept in academia and in terms of being formalized like this. My background, actually, the way I came to it, I was working with some faith communities, churches, and got involved with a drop-in program and got connected with some kids who were facing issues that I hadn't really considered before. My background's rather dull and middle class, and the kids I was working with also had that kind of background, but just in Toronto. I was living in Toronto at the time, and we were outside Toronto, and there were a lot of kids with not a lot to do, so the little town that I was in wanted to give them, you know, an opportunity to get involved or become active, because anytime you see two or three kids hanging around a corner store, you know, you can get nervous. So the town decided to put together a drop-in center for kids that weren't active in sports. And I didn't know anything about it. I had no concept or understanding whatsoever of how a drop-in worked or how you connect with kids who were disconnected and a little bit, you know, on the fringe of things in terms of what they were getting involved in, their activities, and I guess the formal term for it is at-risk youth and whatnot. So I connected with some people who were in downtown Toronto who did have drop-in experience. One was a very old mission, Yonge Street Mission. It's over 100 years old. And they kind of took me under the wing, and I remember I was downtown eating a greasy spoon with two guys who were going to tell me a little bit about youth and the kind of youth that were going to their drop-ins. And they were, you know, we were eating, and they were asking me questions. We went around. We saw some of the places where the kids were sleeping outside in sleeping bags and cardboard boxes, and they talked to me about why kids come into the city, and about 15,000 kids would come in the summer. You know, 5,000 would stay. The rest would go home. They were just sort of trying it out. But the kids who stayed were staying because they were getting involved in drugs, or they were getting involved in the sex trade, or they were just falling into the wrong crowd, or they had been abused, and they didn't want to go home. A whole myriad of reasons. And this was all new to me. So we were walking along, and I had some theological training. I mean, that's my background, right? So I remember staying on this cross street, Gerard and Jarvis, which is my last name, ironically. And they said, "Can we ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." They said, "You know, we were talking to one of the girls who's working the street. She's about, you know, she's 20, and she's got a couple kids already, and she wants to get off the street. She's in the sex trade, a working girl. And involved in prostitution, for those of us who don't know those phrases. And she wants to get off the street. She's got two kids. You work at a little church out in the suburbs. There's a bunch of people go there." I said, "Yeah, there's about 120 people go there." She said, "Someone in that church has got to have a basement where this girl can live." I said, They said, "Yeah, someone who might have a basement, a place for her to live, who can help her get on her feet, help her get her GED, her high school diploma, help her kids, maybe get some shoes, and pay off a little bit of a drug debt that she has so her pimp doesn't come after her. Do you know anybody like that?" I said, "Let me think." And I stood there. This was a legitimate question on that corner. It was very, very real. I'm standing there, and I couldn't come up with an answer. I said, "You know what? The guy's really sorry. I don't think there is anybody." And one guy took his finger, and he poked me hard in the chest, and he said, "Then what the blank good is your God to anybody?" Now, these were also guys of faith, so they were not dissing my faith, but they were very serious about a kind of value or a morality or a lifestyle that couldn't be backed up with regular everyday living. I mean, it's one thing to say really nice things and espouse good beliefs, but if you can't walk the talk, then it's really not that useful to anybody else, and it certainly wasn't useful to this girl. And I sort of crashed at that point. You know, I didn't know what to do. They gave me a book, and they said, read this, it'll help. And I was destroyed because I spent a lot of time learning, you know, how to work in a church and how to be helpful and how to be involved in the community. I wanted to do good things, but I could not come up with an actual practical answer to make a difference. So shortly thereafter, I moved to Halifax, got involved with a nonprofit, a very grassroots organization. I tell you what I did. I went to everybody I knew and said, who's working with the hardest people in the city to work with, the derelicts, the drug addicts, the alcoholics. I didn't even know what phrases to use or where to find anybody. I didn't know anything. So they pointed me to two women who in my mind were like, you know, Mother Teresa. These were amazing women. And who had been working on the streets with guys involved in alcohol and women involved in prostitution and drug addiction and whatnot, living on the streets. And I just followed them around for months. And I did have some skill sets, so we kind of formalized the whole thing. It was so grassroots. It was just, you know, there was no organization to it at all. And we built a little board around it, and we built a little organization. We started fundraising and getting more people involved. And I got to the place where I was standing there at one of the dinners that we put on. And I remember I was standing there thinking, how do I let everybody have that poke your finger in the chest experience I did, that moment of epiphany where the veil is pulled back and you start to ask some really fundamental questions about yourself and about other people. How do I do that? And I knew it was by offering people exactly the same opportunity. Not everybody's ready for it, but for people who are, it is life-changing. And nothing else since today has ever rung my bell like that. I mean, that's what I live for, giving people the opportunity to have that kind of experience. And volunteering, as far as I know, is the best way to do it.
So that is much more than I anticipated, and I loved it. That's such a fabulous journey. And so you had this experience. You were there as what brought you in the first place to the street corner to encounter the kids? It was just a curiosity, or was it just a go at community service?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was just, you know, there was an alignment of I needed to learn something. I found some people who were willing to tell me something. I really didn't even know the right questions to ask. And, you know, it's interesting. I think when most people get involved in volunteering, we don't know why we're doing it. We have a sense of, well, we should do something, or I want to get back, I have so much. I mean, we have all these external motivations for doing it. But if you can get into a space where you can really personalize the experience and really own it and have that epiphany and internalize your motivation, then I think it can become fairly, very transformative. But at first, I need to know something, and so that's how I ended up there.
And then you established it was a nonprofit. That was what came about from your work with those women and the board that you created to support, it was a nonprofit organization?
Yeah, we worked together in Halifax to do that. So we ended up, it was built around a 15-year-old minister, like a little dinner that was held at one of the United Churches in downtown Halifax, and we had men, women coming in, the kids coming in. It was, you know, at first it was kind of line up and get your food, but we wanted to give people as much, we wanted to create as much space as we could for people to have that experience. So so to do that, we became very, very inefficient. Like, we used to get everybody to line up and five ladies from the women's auxiliary who are 60 years older or later could serve, you know, 200 people. So we stopped doing that, and we lined people up, and we took food to people after they sat down. We took pepper and salt to people, and I made other people take around bread, and one person took around the juice, the other person took around the cup. So absolutely everybody who came to volunteer had something to do, which was really important. And then we just, you know, we went from, you know, 10 volunteers to 70 volunteers, but it was built on that dinner. And then throughout the week, we would make connections with people on the street, and eventually a youth drop-in was established out of that, and Halifax is still going to this day on Gottesgen Street.
So what made you leave the nonprofit sector to begin working with a combination of corporations and nonprofits?
Well, after being involved with that nonprofit, and then we were involved with another one that we did some kind of cool programs with in another part of Halifax, eventually I got to the point where I thought, okay, I love working with faith communities, churches, and that kind of thing, but I was interested in a broader audience, and I was interested in the bigger conversations that were happening globally around sustainability and international development kind of thing. And I think companies have are definitely positioned in a leadership role that's really unrivaled by any other type of organization. And I saw that they were interested in getting involved in communities as well. You know, and a lot of the moving parts are the same between a church and a business. How do you create a good volunteer opportunity? How do you optimize it? How do you get people involved? How do you help them move from external motivation to internal motivation? So that was all the same. The context was different. But businesses really are wanting to move out and step out and make contributions that go beyond pure profit. And that really was interesting to me. And we jumped into that area, that field.
Did you see you have a very specific focus for your work, which is to create these programs. How much of a need did you see? How did you see this need? And part of my motivation for asking this question is because I think a lot of people can look at it and say, well, what's the big deal, Chris? You know, if to create an employee volunteer program, you pick a group in your area, you set a date, once every 3 months, you put a send an email around to your employees, you take some pictures, there you go. So what was it that you were trying to fill here?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because you're exactly right. If you want a volunteer program that you can take some pictures at and have some people involved and have an event for a day, you know, or a couple days a year, then it's actually not that hard. And it's far more like event management than anything else. But if you're looking for something more, if you're looking for more value than that, if you're looking for something that can help transform your company, that can increase the productivity of your employees, that can increase the enthusiasm of your employees, but more importantly, that can actually work with partners in the community to make substantial changes that last beyond the picture, the photo op, then there's a little bit more involved to that. But it's like me when I began the process. I didn't know, you know, what it took to do a drop-in. I could explain what a drop-in was, and I could tell you what was involved, but I really didn't understand it until I got involved or got out there and asked some other people what was going on, and I got better questions. And I think when companies think about engaging in the community and getting their people involved in volunteering, for when it comes to volunteering, it seems like a no-brainer. I mean, you find a nonprofit, you order the T-shirts, you get the banners, you plan the date, you have the hot dogs, you send out the press release, you go and paint the wall, which has just been painted the month before by the other company, and then you're done. That's the day. You get 200 people out on a Saturday with the nonprofit, you do some good. So I say painting the wall because, ironically, that is what a lot of nonprofits end up doing, is painting buildings and that kind of thing. Companies when they work with nonprofits. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there is something that can go awry if that's all that companies do when they think about corporate volunteering. And so we wrote a blog, 7 standard requests that companies make. We actually got the list from a group in Australia that works with businesses and nonprofits, and they compiled the 7 most requests by companies and nonprofits when it comes to corporate volunteering. And we looked at that list and we said, you know, on the face of it, nothing wrong with this. I mean, they were things like, we want something that can be done in a day. We want something that has inherent value or innate value or obvious value. We want something that we can do as a team. We want something that that matters. You know, so there's nothing wrong with these requests. The problem is if you only give the company, if you meet the company in all those requests, and you just offer them the one opportunity to clean the playground or to paint the wall, everybody takes the photos and they go home, there's so much value left behind, unrealized. There, what's missed is long-term relationships that can actually solve problems in the community. So that's what's missed. On the underneath of it, here's the bad part. You can actually communicate to 200 people in a company that going and cleaning up a playground, which is good to do, or painting a wall, is actually getting at some of the core fundamental systemic problems that exist in the neighborhood. And it's not. It's part of a process. It's a piece of the whole. But it is actually not solving any problems. We used to, when people came down to serve a meal with us on a Sunday afternoon to this community of 200 people that I mentioned before, this United Church, the first thing I told them was, we are not going to solve issues of hunger and poverty here. You're handing out a plate of food. It's not going to make a dent in that. If they didn't eat here, they would find somewhere else to eat. That is not what this moment is about. This moment is about creating space where we can start to understand the world a little bit differently than we did before, where we can ask better questions, and where we can see that we have a role to play, a part to play in a long-term journey toward making our communities and our neighborhoods and our cities better. And in that is a part of us becoming better, too. And that's what's left behind. When you do an episodic event and you paint a wall or you clean a playground, and that's it for the year, you, in effect, could inoculate 200 employees into thinking there are simple solutions that are easily realized when it comes to problems in the neighborhood. And that's not the case. So what we advocate is going further than that. We advocate taking those steps, getting people involved. That's, one-day events like that are a great way to get people involved. But go further. Go further and realize the real benefit that can be there. And you can get there by just having some conversations and figuring out what needs to be done to benefit the business, to benefit the nonprofit, to benefit the community, and what can benefit the employees. And that takes a little bit more thinking than most people know to do at the beginning.
So let's talk about what the benefits are to the business, because a lot of people who listen to this are business owners. They're young entrepreneurs, they're involved in businesses, and the understanding about how it benefits a good project, how it benefits the cause of the community is clear. So what's the value proposition of a corporate volunteer program for a business?
Well, I think essentially when we talk about the business, we can talk about things like operation. There are benefits to be realized when it comes to the operation of the business. So you can create better company relationships, relations with the community. You can have a positive effect on productivity because the studies show that as morale goes up, productivity goes up, employees will experience greater fulfillment because they're starting to add on pieces that go just beyond, you know, whatever they're making on the assembly line. It's a more holistic approach. There's a value there for sure that translates, as well as skills and abilities. That you can offer employees. When you take a long-term approach and you get employees involved in leadership roles in a nonprofit, on a board, or public speaking on behalf of the nonprofit, or the kinds of skill sets that you can learn from networking, or that kind of thing. When companies are spending an average of $400 to $600 a year on training per employee, this is a real gain in terms of real-life skill set training, and it's also offset some pretty onerous costs that can be a part of training. As well as their studies that show lower error rates, reduced absenteeism, that kind of thing. But that's on operational. I mean, we can focus just in on the skills in terms of an employee benefit because if they get in nonprofits, involved in nonprofits at an organizational level, they can learn things like planning, budgeting, communication, assessment, people, just basic people skills, caring, negotiating, listening, that kind of thing. So those kind of things. Then there's perspective and attitude. HR loves these kinds of things in terms of personal fulfillment, learning to be more innovative, increase social contact, awareness, interest. All these kinds of things help people become more rounded, well-rounded, that definitely is a benefit. And then obviously there are benefits that go, like you mentioned, that go to the community and go to the nonprofit.
And how does it decrease absenteeism at work? And, you know, I know that your specialty is as a researcher, but can you talk briefly about how, I can see how it would bring increased morale, but how does that increase productivity and decrease absenteeism? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it is an interesting study. It's called. It was done by an engineer in, I think it was Pittsburgh, in the 60s. And it's called the two-factor theory or the hygiene theory. And Gallup did a study a little while ago. Have you heard of First Break All the Rules and what's his name? Buckingham.
Yes. Yes. Buckminster Fuller.
No.
well, all right, we'll leave that for a side note.
Okay. I love the book, First Break All the Rules. It's based on a comprehensive study that Gallup did. I don't know how many millions of people and how many thousands of companies were involved. I used to be able to know it right off the top. But they came up with an interesting observation that was exactly the same as that discovered by the gentleman who came up with the two-factor theory. And that is that what makes you unhappy at work is not the same as what makes you happy at work. So what makes you unhappy at work is lousy pay, lousy work conditions, like your cubicle stinks and there's no windows, a lousy boss, those kinds of things, right? That makes you unhappy. If you fix those, it makes a better working condition, but it actually won't make you happy at work. What makes you happy at work, and this is what is part of Buckingham's book, First Break All the Rules, is someone knows you by name, someone's interested in your development, you have a personal relationship to other people. It all has to do with personal fulfillment in who you are as a human being. So when a company takes time and formally offers an opportunity to get involved in community, what they're doing is creating the right kind of space for people to express their personal interests and the personal desires that go beyond just what they're doing as part of the company. And so it integrates their life inside that building or that assembly line or those sales calls with the rest of the world. And if they have a sense, and studies show, and I don't have any off the top of my head, but it makes common sense. If you are more satisfied with who you are as a person in life, you just do better in terms of health, in terms of productivity, in terms of mental acuity, those kinds of things. When you're engaged, you do better across the board. And so companies that are able to connect people to passions and interests where they feel they're making a significant contribution as a person, where they feel like they matter and their business is facilitating it, there is direct correlation and positive benefit that can be realized there.
Well, I'm glad I asked. That's really interesting. And it makes sense about the workplace, the two factors. I think it's a great thing to carry forth in this conversation. Most companies that come to you for your assistance in creating these programs, what are their motivations, or how do you make sure that they're starting from the best type of motivations to create these programs? What's the starting ground?
Well, that's actually simpler than you would think. I mean, we talk about four things you need to pay attention to. One is the thing that most people talk about, that's structure. That has to do with design, program, how many hours we're going to give off, are we going to do it together, are we going to do it individually, are we going to have dollars for doers, all those kinds of things that people talk about a lot. We were involved with a great research project with Bee Bakalandru with the Boston College Center for Corporate Citizenship, and they offer six drivers for effective volunteer engagement and giving programs for companies. It's free download on the Boston College site. I highly recommend it. But those six drivers, those factors, actually, it's a bit like the two-factor theory. If you're not paying attention to those things, if you're not paying attention to how you're structuring it and being intentional about that, your program's going to flop. So you need to do that. But what takes it to the next level, what really helps people realize the value is when they pay attention to the other three conditions of a great, outstanding volunteer program, and that is movement. People have to have a sense of achievement. They have to think, okay, we work here and we're going there. I mean, across the board, that's just a basic human need. I need to have a sense of progress. Spinning my wheels isn't going to work. So companies need to take time with nonprofits to figure out where are we, where do we want to be, and be very clear about those goals. So that means that they need to form partnerships, partnerships where everybody understands what the expectations are, what we want to achieve, where we want to go, what it's going to take, and then we're both all in on that. We've got skin in the game. Then you can actually demonstrate clearly to your employees and to all the participants, even the participants at the nonprofit who may not be involved in your company because you're going to be rubbing shoulders with these people. You can demonstrate what you're achieving together, and you have a sense of success. There's some milestones. You can tick it off. You can say, yes, we're moving towards a goal, and you have a clear sense of goal. And companies need to pay attention to that, and forming actual partnerships for long-term goals is the best practice to achieve that. And the third condition is one of motivation. Like, why are people doing, why would anybody want to volunteer? Well, the business had certain reasons. The nonprofit definitely has reasons for doing it. But the third group usually gets ignored, and that's the employees. Why would they want to do it? What is the personal benefit for our employees? What are they interested in? So taking the time to do some evaluation and understand what people are doing already and where they want to go and why they want to go there, that's very important. So taking the time to actually ask those kind of questions, do some interviews, and discover what are people doing already. Maybe we'll want to build on that. Or maybe it's a combo. Maybe we do something as a company, but we facilitate the individual interests of our group. Like IBM, they put together over 200 online programs where you can learn skills for whatever you want to do. If you want to be on a board, you can go online, take this skill program, and you can be a better board member. Well, that's great. They facilitate for people individually. But maybe you want to combine that with the focus company activity as well. And that approach works really well. But paying attention to what motivates people is really important, which leads us to the last condition, that of space. And we're big advocates of creating the right kind of space to meet people at their highest contribution. Because when people are volunteering for the first time, like I said before, they're very extrinsically motivated. They're not sure exactly why they're there. Like me on that street corner, I didn't know why I was there. I was going to learn. I was going to personalize the whole thing. But that's where I'm starting. So you can't expect too much of that person. Give them an experience. Let them move on. If it's not right for him, that's fine. But if the less obligation you put on a person at the beginning, the more likely they'll find space to own it themselves. And honestly, people kind of, you know, go through three stages when they're volunteering. The first stage is very much like when you're visiting a country for the first time and you're taking in the sights and sounds. You know, you're like a tourist. You're there. You're trying it out, that kind of thing. But if you really like it and go back, you kind of develop some connections. We would call that person a traveler. And you need to treat them differently than you do tourists.
The nonprofits,
and then finally,
too. The nonprofits, yeah.
Exactly. Okay. The nonprofits do. They need to create the right kind of space. And then finally, you know, you've got people who are operating at the highest level. These are people who are all in. It's part of their identity. They have very internal motivation for being there. You do not need to send them an email, and you do not need to remind them to be there, and you do not even ask them to show up and do more. They just will because it's their lifestyle. It's just who they are. Those people we would call guides. And so the business and the nonprofit need to kind of work together to find the right kind of volunteer opportunities so you can have people coming in, trying it out, and then leaving. You can have people try it out and continue on and become travelers, and then finally guides. What the mistake is that nonprofits and businesses tend to treat everybody the same. And so people who are highly invested get asked to sweep, and people who don't know what they're doing get asked to be on a board before they even understand what the community issues are or what the motivation, what the goal is. So that's the last part. I would say might be one of the most important features of what we talk about with companies.
So before you start to develop this partnership and lay out what, you know, before you even develop the partnership with a nonprofit, you should maybe get a sense, as you were saying, of what your employee interests are and their background. But then how do you even select who to partner with in terms of which organization and what type of cause? especially if you're trying to take into account perhaps some of your employees' personal or historical interests.
Yeah, that's really good, because you've got a number of factors that are kind of competing at this point. One, you've got, you know, I'm a big believer in brand alignment.
Mm-hmm.
Mining companies that support soccer, I think, okay, that, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just not good enough,
mm-hmm.
right? So consulting companies that plant trees, nothing wrong with that. You just need more. I mean, there's more to be offered here, and there's more alignment that can happen, because without that kind of alignment, integration to the different business areas within your company, it's more philanthropic than it is corporate responsibility or social responsibility. And again, nothing wrong with that, but if we want to go to the next level, and that's what most people are looking for, and that's what our stakeholders are looking for, and that's the real value that a business and a community can stand to benefit from, then the process, there's a little bit more involved. Like, you really need to take some time, discover who the nonprofits are. You'll have a general idea of which nonprofits kind of fit with your brand, and then you vet them. You spend some time meeting with them. But a really great practice, one that I've seen work well over and over again, is one where companies put together a team of people from the different business areas. So you got people from finance, you got people from HR, you got people from the production line, the assembly line, whatever. Put them on a team together and make sure there's a C-suite level person, somebody from the highest levels of management on that group who can advocate around that boardroom table. Put them together and then find the nonprofit. Take the time to find a nonprofit and then ask the nonprofit to form a mirror team. And then this team gels together. And it's really great if the HR guy or finds an HR guy from the nonprofit, and if the finance, a woman finds a woman in finance, you know, from the nonprofit. That kind of mirror team works really well. They can find a lot of affinity. And I tell you, the best part about that is it won't be built on the personality of the CEO or the executive director or the champion within the company, because when that CEO goes, the whole thing tends to fold like a house of cards. This team approach allows you to institutionalize the relationship beyond the personality. And it also is one of the best ways to facilitate finding the nonprofit in the first place.
That's helpful. But it made me think of a question that I'm wondering if I even stepped over that. If I'm thinking myself, if I were asked by an executive to join a team to put together this type of volunteer program, I would be happy, but I would want to know, well, why? What's the message that the top level or executive need to communicate to employees about what are the motivations for doing this? And I think I am only asking this now because I'm putting myself through the paces as you describe it and realize I would want to have a message from the company that leads me to believe it's more than a PR stunt.
Yeah, again, brilliant question. And I think one that probably, if you restated it, could be applied to CSR in general. I think there are a lot of companies that are getting on, well, you know what, it's probably good that we use less water, it's probably good that we turn off our lights when we're done, it's probably good that we reduce our waste, right? And some of those have an immediate, obvious value. We pay less for trash collection, that's a good thing. You know, we use less water, business saves money, so that's pretty obvious. But if you're going to go beyond that, you're going to go beyond those obvious connections, then you're right. You need to start asking questions about who we want to be and what we can do and how important it is for us to be the kind of company that is building value back into our community. And, it really comes down to that. It comes down to somebody who is a decision maker who has the ability to say, okay, we want to be the kind of company who is building value into our community. We want to exist at that level. Or we have a CSR program and we want to notch it up a bit. We want to rally the troops, and corporate volunteering or volunteering in the community with our employees is one of the best ways to get people active and get them involved and realize some of the potential. I very rarely hear of a company that is so convinced of the business benefit before they get involved in employee volunteering, that it's a no-brainer for them. Like, I mean, I can sit down and talk to them blue in the face about, you know, how if you reduce sick time and you increase productivity by 1%, we're talking about this times X dollars and millions of dollars, right? It's really hard to demonstrate that. I mean, it is just really hard to demonstrate that. Although I think there are programs in place where those kind of metrics can be realized at some level or another, and they get better all the time. But companies that get involved in employee volunteering do it because someone who has the authority to make that decision knows at an intuitive level it's the right thing to do. And I think the way society is going right now, I think there's a push-pull effect around volunteering, and I think more people are interested in it, but I think the reasons for it come afterwards. I think we make an emotional decision, and then we find the facts to justify it later.
Mm-hmm. That certainly seems to be the way that I personally operate. So that's interesting that you say that. So with this volunteer team, then the considerations that they want to balance are a cause and a partner that aligns with the company's brand image. And I agree that that really is important. It's something that I've spoken about and written about. But then they also have to take the pulse of the employees in the company in terms of what their personal interests are and see if there's something that can bridge those differences and do that as best they can. Is there anything else in terms of focusing on an issue or choosing a nonprofit partner that you would say, or any other processes you encourage companies to use?
Well, I think one important thing is after you're done vetting, and there's a way to vet. I mean, it's all just simple common sense stuff. Call people you know about the nonprofit, ask around, ask other nonprofits, get a sense of the reputation. You know, take them out, ask them questions too. And after you get your short list together, I wouldn't do that at the very beginning, but after you get a short list together, two or three nonprofits, you know, date them a little while, see what they're like, try them out a little bit. And even do a one-off volunteering event. I think that's a good example of when a one-off could be a good part of a long-term strategy. But once that's done, once you think, okay, this is the group for us, then sitting around the table and saying, okay, we want you to know, we're not just looking for a photo op. We're not looking for one-year-only thing. We are interested in your goals and your expectations. But we have some goals and expectations, too, for our business, because we're shooting to be more sustainable, more vigorous, more vibrant, more differentiated, stronger, faster, bigger, better, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, businesses need to do that. They need to have those priorities in place on behalf of the shareholders and themselves. So put those out on the table and craft together a memorandum of understanding, if you want to call it that, where you share objectives. The business has objectives, the nonprofit has objectives, and then there are objectives for the employees as well. There's kind of, you've already taken a pulse. You know kind of what they're after, what kinds of things are interesting to them. So include those together. Find the overlap between those three circles. That's the thing to put at the point of your goal setting and whatnot. Those are the things you're all in together on. But then everybody has to have a sense of your priorities are my priorities. So the parts that don't overlap, they have to be committed to those long-term as well. So the company has to be committed to, say, the fundraising efforts or the sustainability of the nonprofit as well. Otherwise, they're forming a partnership that's limp and it won't last kind of thing. And they're going to be investing in a dead-end relationship. So you need to get to that place and spell those expectations out. What does that mean? Is the business going to be putting money in? Is the business going to be offering skills and expertise? When? Now? Later? As we go? As we get a sense of it? What can the nonprofit offer us? Nonprofits have a lot to offer businesses beyond just a volunteer opportunity as well, in terms of advocating for them in the community, including them in newsletters, hosting back and forth, even shared best practices. It's always interesting what businesses can learn from people in the trench making a go of it with, you know, Band-Aids and paper clips. And that's, you know, nonprofits are gorillas out there, and they have a lot to offer as well. So, but a memorandum of understanding, I think, would be a really important piece in that whole process.
Okay, that's helpful. Is there an optimal size of a nonprofit? Or does it, or is there, should a the corporate and nonprofit partners be of their sizes, should they relate to one another?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. And that question comes up, unfortunately, for a lot of companies, it's just not going to be fair. You know, there's a handful of nonprofits that they can connect with. So sometimes you can connect with a cluster, besides like Habitat or something like that, which is a go-to group, or Junior Achiever, so that kind of thing. They're big enough. They can get it. They can handle it. And for a company that wants that kind of, you understand size, you understand infrastructure, you understand bureaucracy, then that's a good marriage. But some more innovative companies are actually clustering nonprofits that share similar objectives within the city. So if you have like three nonprofits around homelessness, that's good for nonprofits too, because they can scale up a little bit in terms of their visibility, and they kind of get away from competing with each other, which the best of us don't do in the nonprofit world. And you can form some associations that give strength and add value to each other. And companies, I think, can lead the way in doing that if they can cluster nonprofits around a cause. Sometimes that doesn't work out. It's just, like everything in life, it comes down to personalities. But that's a good idea.
That's interesting to cluster the nonprofits, and I could see that being very helpful for the community. My next question is kind of like, how long does our essay have to be? What's the minimum words? But I think it's a question that people consider. Volunteering for employees, do you counsel it to be done on work time, paid time off, weekends, an arrangement? I mean, people's personal time and their work time can be hot button issues. So how does that fit into a company volunteer program?
Okay, you're right. This is a hot topic. If you talk to nonprofits, I know some diehard, dyed-in-the-wool hardcore believers who say when a company shows up on company time and people are being paid to be here, it is not volunteering, right? And other nonprofits have said, are you crazy? When a company shows up and is actually paying their people to be here, I can't think of a more committed investment. I mean, the company's actually doing that. They're standing behind it and spending their money on it. So from a nonprofit perspective, that's kind of a hot topic in certain circles. From a business perspective, it kind of runs the gamut. From a slap on the back out the door, you're doing a great job because you go volunteer in your own time, don't be late after lunch. Mm-hmm. To, we offer our people sabbaticals, mm-hmm. paid sabbaticals. A portion of the salary is paid sabbatical. Statistically, I've not seen any proof that one beats the other. However, having been a part of this Six Drivers successful employee volunteer program research, I would say that companies that ante up and are at a place where they say, okay, paid time off, like you can volunteer 40 hours a week throughout the year wherever you want or as part of our program, or we're putting skin in the game, those companies are more successful. I don't think they're more successful because people take advantage of it in the end. I think they're more successful because they just are making a strong statement of, we want you to volunteer, but we're going to stand behind it. We're going to create as much space, as much opportunity as it takes to make sure that you get involved in the community. That kind of statement, I think, is important. So I'm not sure it's so much what is done as the kind of company that is comfortable doing that is going to be more successful, because it's a telltale sign of the culture and climate of that company where they're willing to stand behind their employees in terms of community investment. Now, I'll say that, and a lot of companies, I will say, no, that's just not true, blah, blah, blah. But that is my personal perspective on it.
Yeah, some of the companies that have well-known volunteer programs like Patagonia or Burt's Bees or Timberland, and I know Burt's Bees does the type of paid sabbatical or internship for their employees, and Patagonia. And Burt's Bees and Timberland, I believe, do paid time off or paid time to volunteer. So, and I think I see more companies adopting that. So I guess it's a personal decision between every company and its employees.
Yeah, exactly. What works for one won't work for the other. But, and that's why I said, statistically, I can't say one is better than the other. it's what's behind that's driving the trip that really matters. And if a company can demonstrate clearly to their employees that they are behind it, that they're not just riding the backs of the employee's good efforts and goodwill, because that will destroy your employee volunteer program. And we've seen examples of that happen. That makes a difference. If a company can clearly demonstrate they are supporting it in a meaningful, and when I say meaningful, money, mm-hmm. you know, or resource type way.
Mm-hmm. And in a way that shows sacrifice, yeah. How do you deal with measuring the outcomes given the benefits we talked about, there are a lot of outcomes that can be measured. What do you counsel corporations, businesses to do around this area?
I usually, for one thing, I say you've got to measure it. If you're not measuring it, if you don't know what you're achieving, then I stop and say, okay. And I don't mean how many people showed up. That's an input. I mean, that's not the output measurement that we're after. It's important to know how many people showed up and how much time and that kind of thing. But we want to get to actual results, what's being achieved. And I think that means at the beginning with that memorandum mm-hmm. idea, you have very clear goals. You do them in conjunction with your nonprofit partner, and you set goals for the next few years of what you want to achieve, and you make them measurable. Picking the right goals is far more important than picking goals that can be measured. We can figure that out later. And there's a whole lot of good organizations out there that can do that. Andrew Mercy with Angel Points. Angel Points has two great programs online right now for getting your employees engaged in your CSR program, and then measuring corporate volunteering impact in programs. That's fantastic. He's out of San Francisco. He's got a great program.
And you're LBG. Saying that he can help, I'm sorry, he can help measure the benefits upon the company of these types of programs?
Absolutely, yep, absolutely. Mission measurement is another one. True Impact with Fran Levy in Boston, they do a great job. They have an online tool, very easy to use. And I know LBG in Canada, Simpact, operated by Simpact, they're hosted by Simpact, they're doing good work around standardizing inputs and outputs so companies can understand what the effect is. So there are organizations out there that specialize in this. They have good data, they have good connections, good communities, and they're already offering it. It can be done. So there's no real excuse for a company that can't say in their annual report or online and using social media, you know, we gave out 10,000 basketballs, and here's how our community is better. That translates into kids being involved in sports, which keeps them in school, which means that our dropout rate over the last 2 years has dropped by 20%. And kids who stay in school are less likely to end up, you know, in jails and that kind of thing, which saves our state X amount of dollars. So, you know, just to take the next step and actually begin to measure beyond how many volunteers showed up and try and estimate what the value of their time is far more important, and companies need to be able to do it. We do it in every other area of business. We can certainly do it here, and the tools are out there to do it.
That's really interesting that the tools are out to measure the benefits upon a business, and that's exciting, and I'll put some links to some of these in the post. But does the business have to measure their social outcomes, or can they say, hey, nonprofit partner, you take care of that, and I'll weave that into my end-of-year report, my CSR report? Does it need to be measured together with a nonprofit, or is it two sets of measurements? And this, is, again, is talking about the impact of the service project.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. I think I know some businesses who've kind of left it to the nonprofit to measure. And those nonprofits do as best they can. But I think, again, we're leaving a little bit of value on the table if the business isn't stepping up to offer their expertise, their network connections, their skill sets in measurement. And I think the business misses some realities of that process in terms of, wow, we are doing this or we aren't doing that. And in the end, this one company that I'm thinking of, they left it to the nonprofit to measurement. And in the end, they just get a bunch of badly filled in Excel spreadsheets because it's a volunteer from who knows where trying to fill something out for a company that they don't even understand what the company really needs. So So it didn't work well in that case. And I don't know, unless we're talking big nonprofits, if that's a good idea. I think you just miss an important aspect of the relationship. So doing it together would, in my mind, make a lot of sense because there's a lot to be achieved there.
And then do you work with companies on structuring their message once they have this program in place and it's well-oiled and the nonprofit and the employees and the company's objectives all seem to be getting met? How do they communicate it to the public, and how do they receive that benefit of the program, which is the public knowledge and awareness of it?
Well, as you know, I'm a big supporter of and believer in social media, and I think we formed a partnership with 3BL Media just for that, because taking this message out to some of the most interested, some of the most active people out there within, you know, that are in social media who are engaged on this topic, I think is a really easy win for companies. It's great. Write the CSR report, hand that out, mail it out, that's fine. But let's go the next step and let's make it a dialogue. Let's interact with our stakeholders. Let's interact with the broader public. Because in the end, isn't that why we're doing it? Isn't that what we're doing to demonstrate, to clearly demonstrate a benefit to the community? I mean, doing the good thing. But if you're doing the good thing but you're not talking about it, again, we're missing some opportunity there in terms of being a leader, in terms of creating a bit of gravity pull towards other companies saying, you know, we should be doing something too. And I think that's an important thing for companies to realize, that when they're doing something good in the community, the more they can communicate that effectively to audiences that want to hear about it and will talk about it and spread the good word, the more we can create a sort of a pull, a gravitational well towards this different way of doing business, where we pay attention to people, profit, and planet. But people have to know we're doing these good things. Just doing them and being quiet about them, there's a value to that. But I mean, we miss the opportunity to draw other people in and get them excited and get them involved as well.
I totally agree. But a lot of companies out there are thinking, well, how do I do this? I mean, I don't want to get my wrist slapped for looking like I'm cause washing, even though I've followed Chris and, you know, I've gotten all these stakeholders involved and we're creating this company and we're measuring our results. But the communication is a scary thing, because all of a sudden you're putting something that can be, feels personal to your company, out in front of the public for their evaluation.
Right, and I'm probably not going to say anything different than any of your other guests who have discussed this, and that is, if you're going to get involved in this in a real meaningful way, it's just the same as having a conversation over coffee. The person who's listening to you has to be allowed to ask the question, which may be, really? Honestly, that's what happened? Or how is that good? I mean, and you're right, that can be very scary for companies that are used to having one-way conversations with the public, but we're moving past that now. I mean, that's an old era. That's pre-printing press type of thinking, and now that social media is out, and now that we can have these two-way conversations, I think companies that get practiced in it and adept in it are going to be able to head and lead. So how do you do that? I think you just... it's not so much about having the perfect strategy, although you got to think through that. I think it's about taking incremental steps. So start slow. You know, start with just a moderate presence in social media. Get to know some of the people. Learn, listen, watch, engage, offer something valuable. Everything you need to know about social media is free online. But there are people you can hire too who will, you know, help you move faster than you would on your own. And the community out there, as you know, Olivia, a community out there around social media, in social media around corporate social responsibility and sustainability and green issues, is by and large a very friendly, positive. We want things to be better. We want to help people get better. The only time people go crazy is when you have a case like Nestle, where they had a bad video go viral on them, and then they try to control the conversation. And in social media, you aren't controlling conversation. You're actually, it comes across trying to control people. which is just awesome. And those things can be great opportunities, I think, for companies. But you may want to engage some expertise just to think through some of that. But it's not as hard, and it's not as ambiguous as you might think once you get in. I mean, and you know this from personal experience, you're very adept at social media yourself.
Thanks. That was a good explanation. What about the size of a company who wants to create a program? If even if they're small, 10 employees or under, still a good idea? Still powerful?
Yeah, actually, it's probably a little easier. I'm going to be in Toronto talking to the group. That the average size of the company, I think, is 5 to 12. But there you're going out like a little family to do your volunteering. And so you don't have to worry about things like participation rates and getting people to show up. And yet, because, I mean, you kind of, it's a tight-knit group. And I think the benefits are also really easily, quickly realized, because you can share the experiences and you get to institutionalize the experience. And you probably don't even need to worry about it, you know, a team, a leadership team to form partnerships, because in one way or another, everybody in that company is probably doing something to make sure that it works, that business works. And so that just translates over. So I think it's a great opportunity for small companies, and it's a very accessible opportunity. And I think there are some real easy wins for a small company over a large company.
Okay. And we've been talking about programs that have been, that include company and employee buy-in, but there's some companies out there, and I think I've done some research. I think Zappos looks like one of them, and Zappos is the online shoe retailer, a terrific company, really cutting edge in a lot of regards in terms of their employee appreciation and customer service. And it seems that they have community service programs, but they don't seem to be formalized. What, in this case, what's the company missing out from having a formalized program and instead just having maybe an informal community, committee of volunteers organizing events several times a year?
In Zappos' case, I would say they're probably not missing out on anything. They're just crazy. They're a crazy company. They're a great example of engagement and of hiring the right people, having the right people on the bus, A-level players in A-level jobs. I mean, they make mistakes, but I mean, they're phenomenal. And if they can, they know the rules so well that they can break them and still be good as gold. So I haven't looked into specifically how their employee volunteer program works, but I would say in terms of the four conditions, they are playing hardball. They're major leaguers. And whether they formalized an approach and have all that extra structure around it, I think they're just at a place where that's so internal, they don't need it anymore. A bit like when you're learning mathematics, arithmetic, you have to write it out longhand. Mm-hmm. And then later on, when you know it, you can kind of do it in your head. I think that's where they're at.
Yeah, I'm glad I asked. But that's interesting.
Yeah, that's just my opinion based on how I see corporate volunteering affecting cultures within community companies.
I think I've got, let's see, maybe one more question for you. And this is an interesting one that came up during our conversation, because we talked about, for example, you mentioned a consulting company that goes and plants trees, and there's really a lot of value that's not being tapped. What have you noticed from volunteer projects that are more service and work and hands related to more white collar volunteer projects? And is there one that fits a company better? Are they both credible? Do employees feel the same type of benefit and engagement from doing a more white collar volunteer project than one where they're going out and attending a drop-in center, as you said?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and most people don't think to ask it. I have a strong bias towards proximity. So that means that when you're volunteering, the closer I can get people to other people or to the issues that they're working with, like, the more dirt I can get under your fingernails regarding, and I mean that metaphorically, regarding, unless it's an environmental thing, regarding the program or the community issue or whatever, the more that's going to sink inside of a person, the more opportunity people get to personalize it. Because remember, that's what we're after. We're after getting people, these employees, these participants, to move from external motivation to internal motivation, personal, intrinsic motivation. And that is best facilitated by getting them in the field, right? Get them to be a bit of a practitioner. So I'm not a big fan of taking people from a company and sticking them on the board, because I always wondered, do you really get what these people are about? And so will other people on the board, and I guarantee you the staff of that nonprofit is always wondering too. But if that person has worked alongside of their volunteers at the staff of the nonprofit, and they actually know Bill's name or Bob's name, or they actually have gone out and seen what kind of issues they're addressing in the community, whether it's pollution or whether it's planting trees, anybody who's got the street cred and then is on the board, far more reliable, far more authoritative, far more helpful, just better across the board, and better for that employee too. So that's my bias. Having said that, there are some companies that lend themselves to white collar type work, as you mentioned, and there are nonprofits that are crying for these kinds of skills, accounting or
right. I think Deloitte is a great they're a great example. They've had the program in place for years.
Yeah, but even with Deloitte, I would say the best people are going to be the people who have done a little of both. Like, go in and help them with their strategic thinking. That's great. Do the consulting. Ladle some soup out on a Saturday so you really, really, get it inside of you, because, again, that's always what we're after. We're after that epiphany, that moment where the person goes, I see something now. And sometimes it's hard to get when you're sitting on a board or you're just doing some consulting in a nice room with people who are a lot like you.
You know, I'll share a quick experience myself. That's basically the feeling that I've had. I've been doing what I refer to as pro bono work for this new nonprofit that's a fundraising platform for other nonprofits in the online and social media. And it really is volunteer work, but it doesn't have that same type. I believe in their mission, but I'm doing things at a very high level that I would do in my other paid positions. And so there's there's an emotional component that's not getting tapped, and so I don't even consider it volunteer. I say, sure, I guess I'm a volunteer,
right,
but really I'm doing pro bono work for them. So,
right. There's nothing wrong with that, as long as if you have the other parts of the continuum, so you have a sense of movement, a sense of accomplishment, and you've internalized your motivation, then that's fine. But I agree with you. You kind of need both for it to be really meaningful.
The last question I have for you is, if a company doesn't have a corporate volunteer program, what is the if you could distill it down with all the great benefits you share, but what's the biggest thing that they're missing out on without such a program?
Better people. Hands down, that's the thing. Better people. Companies have an opportunity. Isn't that what we want with leadership? Don't we want to be the kind of people, as a leader, to say, because I was in this role as a leader, I facilitated meaningful change. I made a meaningful contribution. People's lives were made better. The world is better. Isn't that, when we are put in the ground, when we're in that box at the front of the church and that person stands up, you do not want that guy to say he made great choices in terms of what he bought and what he didn't buy. He had great lawn furniture. He had a lot of money in his account. He made our company billions, and we all had more vacations because of it. That is not what we want said at the end of our life. What we want said is, this person made a significant impact on my life. I would not be the same without him. She offered me so many opportunities to become more of who I was meant to be. That's phenomenal. I will miss her dearly. That's what we want said at the end of our life. Well, as leaders, we can offer that to people, all these people who show up and punch the clock under our watch, in a company. That's what we can offer as leaders. That's what we can contribute to the world. And that's where we start making, we're writing our obituary every single day, and this is where we can make some huge strides. When we offer people the chance to have these epiphanies, it's not everybody's going to have it, but you create the space where people become more of who they are and realize their true value and their true worth. That's where we get the name for our company, Realize Worth. When people realize their worth, and they realize the worth and the value of the people around them, and the axis of the earth tips a little bit and the world's a little bit different and it's a little bit better because you were in that role and you made that possible, that's important. That's really what matters. That's what it's all about. And so better people, that is the most important reason, beyond money, beyond anything else that we've talked about. That's it, number one.
Chris, do you like your job?
I'm totally uninterested in doing anything else, so I guess that means yes.
This was just fabulous. I will say, at the risk of offending other people, this is one of my favorite interviews, and I know I took a lot of your time because I had so many questions. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you want to impart before we wrap up?
No, just that I've enjoyed myself as well, and it's always wonderful to meet people, even if it's over the phone, beyond Twitter or LinkedIn or anything like that. And I'm really going to enjoy getting to know you more, Olivia, and I hope this is a benefit to some people. I think this is a great thing that you're offering. I really appreciate the opportunity to be a part of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Chris, this is really, I'm not putting you on.
For more interviews about Cause Capitalism, visit causecapitalism.com.